This computer. Hi, this is Circe Olson Wesley. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking with Rick Tavares today. He's a brat and an author, and he's contributed many stories to our different anthologies. And now he's written a novel titled It Began in Japan, and we're here to talk about it today. Hey, Rick.
Aloha, Circe. Glad to be here.
Well, so before we get into your book, let's talk about your childhood a little bit and how it shaped you. I've known you for many years, and you're always referencing Hawaii. You say aloha, which you just did, and mahalo. And when you heard I was moving here, you sent me vocabulary words and sightseeing tips and, you know, what to eat and where to go. Why is Hawaii so special to you?
Well, having been born there and raised and, you know, there's just, as you know, because you're there now, just the natural beauty of the diverse cultures. Mm-hmm. And for me, there's just a, when I go there, there's just like a calmness. And I you know, I don't know how to explain it. It's just, I just feel so comfortable there. And you know, I was there last year, and, you know, it was just, it was so good to see family again. Of course, it wasn't like, Hawaii is not like it was when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, you know, living with my maternal grandparents, you know, our area was kind of like a jungle almost. I mean, we'd play outside and I'd grab a mango if I was hungry, or a banana off the trees in the yard and stuff. Well, you know, now when I went back last year, it's like a concrete jungle. Mm. You know, but you know, there's still that natural beauty there. You know, I have family there. Both my paternal and maternal grandparents and family members are, most of them are still there. And, but yeah, that's pretty much, I have so many memories there, wonderful memories. And every time I go back, I mean, I tell people it's a great place to visit, but I don't particularly want to live there at this particular point, you know, in my life. But I every time I go back, I think about, why aren't I living here?
Well, it sounds like you consider Hawaii home, even though you don't live there.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, to use an old cliche, you know, is that, you know, my heart will always be in Hawaii, whether I live there or not. I will always call Hawaii home, you know.
So I didn't know that about you, that you had grandparents still living here and family. A lot of things I didn't know about you until I read your book, but you're also a veteran. So how long did you serve and what branch were you in?
I was in the Air Force. And I was in, I spent 21.3 years, not that I'm counting, I spent 21, you know, in the Air Force myself. But, you know, I don't think I've known anything else but the Air Force. You know, I started out as a military brat, you know, and then I did my own time and I've retired and I still connected to the Air Force. So it's like, I've never left the Air Force. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, you even volunteer at the VA hospital, I think, right? Well,
no, it's the Brooke Army Medical Center, and it's one of the largest hospitals in the Department of Defense. And so, yeah, I do some volunteer work out there. I do 3 days a week, and various wards and stuff like that. So, you know, yeah,
you can't leave the military.
Yeah, I still stay connected. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So your family and you have been stationed in some pretty amazing places. So tell our listeners about your growing up years and what were some of the highlights of your brathood?
Oh, I don't know if we have enough time.
Two.
Okay. Well, you know, just the travel and, you know, with my father being a military brat, you know, obviously, I was born in Hawaii, and then we went to Germany, and that was an amazing experience because being in Germany, we took you know, trips to places like Italy, you know, the Vatican and, you know, the Netherlands. And, you know, so we traveled around Europe. So that was really neat. And, you know, from Germany, we went out to Southern California. From there, you know, Arizona. And then I went back to Hawaii because my father went to Vietnam. So we went back to Hawaii to stay there with my maternal grandparents. And then we moved to Japan. And, you know, as an adolescent, I think that had a really profound impact on me as an adolescent growing up in Japan. It was kind of it kind of formed my worldview where, you know, as you know, military brats, you know, we're a microcosm of our society and, you know, we're not monolithic. And that's when I got in touch with all of that, being an adolescent. You know, I hung around, you know, people, we were all military brats, but we all came from different parts of the world, right, had different experiences, went to different places, and we got along. And so, you know, that really kind of stood out for me, is that how, you know, we all came from different places, different experiences and all this other stuff. And but yet being in Japan and going to school there, it just connected. And, you know, we formed, you know, for some people, lifelong relationships with. And, you know, one of the things that I've talked about people, you know, so I graduated from high school in Japan. But so when I went to college, you know, we talked about living in a bubble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking 1967. So I come back to the States to go to college. And all of a sudden, it was just like a major cultural shock for me.
Right.
It's because, you know, there was all this anti-war demonstration. Well, my father went to Vietnam. You know, a lot of the soldiers that were wounded, you know, came to our hospitals, and some of us volunteered and talked to them. Mm-hmm. And here I come back to the States, and, you know, all this anti-war movement and all these racial, and so a lot of the stuff that we kind of weren't in touch with, all of a sudden I go to college and boom, it's all in my face. Right. So, right. You know, those kind of experiences really, you know, although they were great experiences, coming back to the States was a whole different game for us.
Well, you know? Speaking of coming back to the States, I know that brats can pick up the pieces and just go and move on, you know, never look back. And,
right.
And many of us brats talk about the culture shock and, you know, the right. Move on. But it seems to me that you, especially through all our conversations, you've kept in touch with some of your high school friends forever. And so I wanted to know, did you, when you left and you went back to college, did you stay in touch with them right out of high school, or did you have to find them again later, like on social media or something?
Well, shortly after high school, when I went to California, I stayed in touch for about a year, and then we just kind of like drifted apart after that. You know, I think the last time I saw my best friend, Jeff, was spring break in April of 68. Four or five of former high school friends, we all met at my apartment for spring break. And that was really the last time I saw most of those folks until 2015, when we kind of stayed in touch, but not physically.
Right.
You know, we knew of stories, and there were, you know, high school reunions, and I never participated in those because I was all over the world and stuff. So I never participated in them, but I would hear things about people and how they're going. So I didn't physically see anybody really until 40 years later in 2015, when I went up to visit them in Seattle. So, yeah, you know, and that's kind of where we started talking about writing.
Yeah. So just very quickly. So how was it seeing them after 40 years? Were they old?
We all are.
Yeah.
If I could tell this real quick story, there was this guy, Greg. It was funny because we were talking about this. He was like awesome football player. He was a great guy, but he was just like, you know, he was all Far East and everything, you know, offense, defense. He was just a great football player. So when I was going, I had this vision of, God, Greg was like, you know, 6'2", and, you know, like 225. And, you know, I wonder what he's like now. So when he walks into the door, I saw him, when I go to Seattle, he walks in the door, I'm looking down at him.
And wow. I'm like,
oh, wow. What happened? You know, and I kept staring at him and staring at him like I had envisioned him a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally said to him, hey, look, dude, you may be wondering why I'm staring at you. I said, let me tell you. And he goes, yeah. I said, and you've grown some, right? And I go, yeah, no, not really. I said, I've been the same height. I was in high school. It's the same height I am now, 6 foot, you know? And I said, it was just an amazing that you see these transformations that, or you had these stereotypes or images of what
they were at high school,
and you see them and it's like, nah.
You see, that's why I don't go to reunions, because I want everybody to remember me at 16. So listen, let's talk about it began in Japan.
Yes.
I said that this was, you know, your first, I think I said that this was your first book. I know you've written a lot of stories for the museum's anthologies, but is this your first book or have you written other things before?
No, this is my first book. And it was my visit to Seattle in 2015 where I got the idea for writing the book. But what got me going was Bunny Brown, who's one of my champions. She introduced me to your museum. And I started writing those anthologies and I'm going, those stories for the anthologies. And I started thinking, maybe I can do this. Boy, was I wrong.
Well, I was just saying, I went to that Van Gogh experience that everybody went to, and I'm like, I could paint like Van Gogh. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you didn't say, well, no, I can't write, because you have written, and I'm glad you did.
Yeah, well, you know, I've written speeches, I've written policy manuals, and, you know, being an adjunct professor, I've written course syllabi and, you know, presentations. And so but never, ever a book. And gosh, was that not only was it an arduous undertaking, it was so time consuming and labor intensive, as you know.
Yeah. I get the sense that your high school friends influenced some of the characters in your book. Is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I owe a lot to them, because they were, you know, when we met in 2015, they encouraged me to write and to tell the story because of my overactive imagination, I guess. I don't know. And so I went back to San Antonio and I got to thinking about it. So I wrote a prologue and I had an idea of what my story was going to be. So I flew back in November to Seattle to sit down and run it by them. And you know, the character, the narrative, and, you know, the whole character development and all that other stuff. And, you know, and that's how I got started. And so, yeah, I did. The four people are four of my best friends from high school.
Three. Well, being clear, it is a fiction work. We want to, so that people don't think when they're reading the book that this really happened.
Yes, the operative word is fictional, yes.
There is a lot of material, but you can tell there's a lot of material from your own brathood and growing up. So what I want you to do is just give us a tiny little bit, without giving away any of the story, give us a little tiny bit of what is the book about.
Well, the essence of the book is really contained in the prologue and the quote. And the quote is, "The relationship between military brats can't be broken regardless of the years, miles, or circumstances that separates them." So it's really about a story of four teenagers with varied backgrounds, mm-hmm. Navigating, you know, the complexities and the nuances of life. And, with the idea that, you know, because of their friendship and it's grown over the years, they pretty much will do anything to help each other out. So the narrative basically is just following, it chronicles the story of these four people, you know, over a 50-year period.
Yeah, but it is an action adventure kind of thing as well. So it's kind of, yeah, because I don't want people to think it's a memoir. It's a novel. It's a novel with some fast-paced fast-paced pieces, fast pacing, there, something like that. So when writing a mystery or a whodunit kind of book, do you find it hard to figure out all the pieces and parts of the plot so they're believable and followable? And, you know, that would be hard for me. I have very little imagination. Well, for these kinds of things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, initially I just wanted to write a story about military brats, but they said, oh, that's not going to sell. You need to tell the murder mysteries. Those are the ones that sell. So I go, mm-hmm. Okay. So as I started formulating the narrative, it was very difficult. And, mm-hmm. But one of the things I wanted to do writing a fictional murder mystery is I wanted to make the narrative as authentic as possible. Mm-hmm. For example, I use, Adam, the character Adam and Elizabeth go on their first date to this King and I restaurant, which is a Thai restaurant. Mm-hmm. And during a certain period of time, I don't recall what year it was. Mm-hmm. So I go on the internet and Google the King and I in Belleville, Thai restaurant. And the first thing I see is it's closed.
Oh.
Oh my God. So I have to go back and research this. Okay, was it closed during this time period?
Right. No, that's good. That's good work because, I would be asking, huh, this sounds like such a great restaurant. Wow. Oh, it didn't even exist back then. It's a new modern one, So yeah, no, that's good. That's really, really good. So when you wrote this book, do you do an outline so you know how it's going to flow, like chapter one is this and chapter two, or do you just write, like some people are outliners and some people are wingers. What are you?
Oh, this is going to sound so arrogant. I'm a winger.
Well, I don't know. I mean, winger is not even a word, I doubt, but.
I would say I'm partially I'm a winger because never having written a book before, I decided, I'm going to take a master class by James Patterson, probably one of the most prolific best-selling novelists we have. So I took a master class. And one of the things he said in this master class is he does an outline. Now, it's not a very detailed outline, but mm-hmm. he does an outline. And then, they look at the outline, they massage the outline, and then he starts writing. Mm-hmm. I thought, that's a good idea. And I started to do that. And it just didn't work for me for whatever the reason. And the arrogant part of all of this is my outline was in my head. I knew the story. I knew what I wanted to tell, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which probably made it a little more difficult for me when I was writing the story, mm-hmm. because one of my idiosyncrasies mm-hmm. is that as I let things, like, for example, I'll see a movie, I'll read a book, mm-hmm. watch a TV show, mm-hmm. or talk to somebody, whatever. And I get this idea like, I can add that to the book, or I can make an adjustment and it could fit in the book. Wow. So I have to shift and do things. And so that was one of the things that created confusion. If I had an outline, I probably wouldn't have done that and stuck to the outline.
Right. When you're writing about dogs and cats, you can't keep throwing in unicorns and rabbits.
Exactly. And that's what I was doing.
Well, So I think you've already started to tell us what is the hardest thing about starting a book is staying focused. But what was the hardest thing for you about starting the book? And then conversely, what was the easiest thing about writing the story?
Well, I think I mentioned to you that, I started writing in the first person and then listening to certain people, they said, most books are in third person and stuff like that. And I go, okay. I guess the hardest part is that I've never written a book before and I really didn't know what I was getting into. Writing articles, I got that. I'm okay with that, but writing a book was so different. And so I kind of went into a little blind and I was listening to people's opinions. And then there's the issue of grammar. I was an academically underachieving high school student and English is not any of my, I took it because I had to get my degree. I had to take English. And so my English background, unlike my son, who that's his major, but English was not my thing. So, you know, there were grammar guidelines and things that I had to follow. And, you know, I'm just into telling stories. That's how I fashion myself as a storyteller, not a writer. I'm a storyteller who decided to write a book. So I didn't really have a point of reference. And so I kind of just called on my own experiences being in the military. You know, the Air Force taught me, you know, they taught us how to teach and, mm-hmm. you know, write test questions and all these other things. And then, you know, my being an adjunct professor and all that other stuff. So I just kind of, you know, called on those experiences to help navigate me through this whole ordeal. And it was, like I said before, it was a very difficult process for me. That's why it took as long as it did. I just kept shifting.
Right. But I think what you've answered the second part by saying that you're a storyteller. So telling the story would have been the easiest thing for you. You have the story in your head. And if I had said, okay, give me your book, you could have told me the whole book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, absolutely. You said you listened to a bunch of people, different people, and then you chose a very unusual way to write the book. So it unfolds in real time, you know, kind of like the Twilight Zone, only not quite like that, but like that. Was that hard to do? I mean, you're writing in real time. He looks at her. He jumped over the cliff, you know. Was that hard to do? And why did you choose that style?
I have no idea. Yes, it was difficult.
One of those people, right? Just
well, you know, I really like the idea of starting it out back then and then coming to the present and then going back and, you know, making those shifts. And but, you know, it was difficult because I would mix up my tenses.
Yeah. Well, it is difficult to write in that style consistently. It is.
Yeah. So I probably won't do that again.
But at least you're now a subject matter expert in the process of writing like that. So where do you get your support? So you're going through this and you keep calling it an ordeal. I guess I would call it the creative process, you know, to spin it differently. But where do you get your support? Do you belong to a writer's group or a Facebook writing group? I know you said you took a masterclass with James Patterson.
Right. Yeah.
Was that something live? Like you could talk to him, you could talk to people in the class?
No, but you could send questions and stuff to him. Uh-huh. But let's see. I didn't belong to any writer's group or anything like that, primarily because I don't see myself as a writer, and this is the first shot at it, and I didn't feel comfortable. Because I probably would have been embarrassed and I didn't want to be embarrassed, you know, so there was some ego involved in that. The support that I got were from friends, people like, you know, the people in the story, you know, kept asking, how are you doing? Where's it going? And how are you at? And then, you know, Bunny Brown, and then writing the articles for you guys, you know, kept me going because it, you know, I would, hey, I can do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just reminded me of doing that. So yeah, I probably should have, and there are active writers groups around here in San Antonio. So it's not like I couldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. But at the time I just didn't feel adequate enough that, you know, because I don't have that background.
Right. Right. And some of them can be pretty intimidating.
Yes.
Some of them are like, you can't come to the meetings unless you've published X amount of things, or we're going to sit and critique you and tear you apart. Yeah. But then some of them are very supportive too, you know, and offer advice. So what would you say to other people who have all these great ideas moving around in their head, much like you, but they don't think they can write a book or they don't think anybody would be interested in reading it? What do you say to those people?
Do it. But don't follow my example. Do it, but don't follow my example. You know, one of the things that I learned, Kevin Kwan, who wrote the trilogy of Crazy Rich Asians, one of the things he said was, you know, write what you know. And so I would encourage people, you know, to write what you know, even though I had to do research. I mean, you know, you know, Elizabeth is a nurse. Well, I've never been a nurse. Now, I worked in an outpatient mental health clinic as a psychiatric technician, so I knew about medical, but I didn't know about nursing.
Right.
So I had to do research, and I had to call upon other kind of people, and so the research kind of took me out of that. But the storyline was something I knew. Mm-hmm. And so I would tell people, and then, you know, it can be done because I did it. you know, so it's not like it can't be done.
Right. You say, just do it.
Yeah, just do it. As they say at Nike, just do it. And, you know, and I will tell people, you know, it's an arduous endeavor. It's time consuming. It's labor intensive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't do it by yourself. You need to call other people to help you with that effort. And I did. I would bounce ideas off of friends and stuff and say, hey, I'm doing, what do you think about that? Because the overarching thing of this book is I wanted to, even though it's fictional, I kind of wanted to make it as authentic as possible as well.
Right, right. But you also want to have friends that are going to be honest. You know, you don't want friends that are just going to say, oh, this is great.
Right.
You know, they want you to.
I have some of those.
Feedback. So what was the thing you learned about yourself while writing this book? Did you learn anything about yourself?
I can do it, but I know I can't do it by myself. And, you know, I need, you know, as I said already, I need help. I think that one of the things I would say is you need a trusted editor. Mm-hmm. If you remember this example, it just resonates with me, and I think it's hilarious as heck. When I first gave you my draft and you said, Rick, how many 16-year-olds do you know that use the word serendipitous?
Well, I didn't want to mention that I had.
And I go, good point.
Yeah.
You need somebody like that that's going to say, hey, dude, really? Serendipitous for a 16-year-old? And there were other things you said, but that I thought that was hilarious. So I like that. And I think that people need to take a look at, you know, what you know, going into this, I knew I could tell a story, but I didn't know if I could write it. So I had to look at, you know, what are my strengths and weaknesses in this process? And then where it's my weakness, I need to find somebody that's their strength, because it would make my weakness, you know, a little stronger. So, you know, I would say you need to do a little bit of that, and then, you know, be flexible with your time, that it is labor intensive. It is time consuming. And if you're going to really do a, you know, like I would write for an hour or two or maybe three, depending on how it's going. And then I'd put off and go do something else and then come back. And then I'd change it again, or I get an idea. And so, you know, it's going to take time. It did for me. You know, so.
Well, yeah, no, I think what you're saying is it required discipline too. I mean, you know, self-discipline. Mm-hmm. You had to sit and actually do the work. It wasn't just that you sit there and write a blog that's spontaneous. You had to do it. Right. So now that you've got one under your belt, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Working on anything else? Is there another project? Are you having a sequel or something else?
Okay. Yes, I will do a sequel. But before I do that, I have a. This is shifting genres now. I'm writing a romance novel, and it's called "Her Today Is His Tomorrow," and it's about an older American gentleman who just went through a divorce and decides to go to Paris because that's one of his favorite cities. And he just wants to go there to do things. He's a professor at a university. So during the Christmas break, he decides to go to Paris and, you know, spend Christmas in Paris.
Sounds charming.
And he just wanted to go there just to do things he hadn't done before.
Right.
And just explore and just have fun. He wasn't looking for romance or anything like that. He was just going there. Mm-hmm. And then he, you know, encounters somebody. And so he has to leave because he's got to go back for class. And he makes a commitment that I'll come back during the summer. Well, it starts off in December of 2019. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in March of 2020 is
coronavirus. COVID. Yes. Ah, so, don't tell anymore. It's still ongoing,
their relationships developed through the use of social media because they can't get, he can't come back during the summer, nor can she. So they use social media for the next 2 years. So, you know, it's WhatsApp, you know, text message, emails, phone calls. So they'd use social media to further develop their relationship. And that's all I'm going to say.
Well, yeah. Well, it sounds charming because you know what? It's the reality. I mean, it's another one of these things where you've got a novel that's got a lot of relatable stuff to the rest of us. We've all had to use social media. We're using it today to communicate. Exactly. So very good. Well, I'm excited when that comes out. When do you think that's going to be?
I would like to finish it by the end of the year. I've already got 8 chapters done, the prologue and 8 chapters. So I'm hoping to get it done by the end of the year.
It'd be nice to have it ready for December.
Yes. Yeah, that's the goal.
Thematic marketing. Start in December and market in December.
Well, you know, I even have the cover picked out already.
Oh, well, there you go. I'll share it with you. Yeah, I'll share it with us. So speaking of books, but we want to go back to It Began in Japan. Where can they buy It Began in Japan? Available in paperback or ebook? What's the deal on it?
Right now it's on Amazon. And I tried to do Kindle, but I was having difficulty with the cover because the cover is a PDF and Kindle wants it HTML or whatever it is, it's a different format and I don't know how to convert it. And then I tried to use one of their canned book covers, and I couldn't get that process working out. So right now it's just on Amazon until I get a chance to work it out with Kindle, and then I'll see if I can put it on Kindle. But right now it's just Amazon.
It's a paperback. Okay.
Paperback, yes.
So they can Google, they can go onto Amazon or they can Google it. And it's called It Began in Japan. Mm-hmm. I'll put the Amazon link in the notes underneath this one so that people can just click and go.
I think you may know one of the interesting things too is that they ask you, you know, certain words that if people were to look up your book, there would be certain words. So I put things like military brat. Mm-hmm. I put Japan, Yokota Air Base, Johnson High School. Mm-hmm. So I did things like that people could, you know,
in the middle of the night, get up and say, boy, I wonder if there's anything out there about Johnson High School, and then that'll bring up your book.
Yes.
Very good. So in the few minutes we have left, is there anything you would like to tell our listeners that I haven't asked?
Well, because I believe in y'all's mission, the museum's mission, all the proceeds from this book, I will be donating to you all.
Wow.
Because I want you to continue to promoting the military life of the military family. And I like what you guys are doing. And I just thought that, you know, in some small way, I would like to give back. And I just thought that, you know, continue doing the great work that you guys are doing. And so, yeah, I'm donating it.
Wow. That is so generous. That is so awesome. And all of your work, and you don't see any of the profits, but, you know, we appreciate it so much. You know, it's an important story that we're telling. And it deserves to be told and shared. Anything else you want to say? Is there anything that I missed? I didn't ask you a whole lot, but.
Yeah. No, other than that, you know, my reward for doing the book was just doing the book. Mm. Knowing that I could do it.
Right. You're a published author. You have something to talk about at cocktail parties.
Now. Well, I wouldn't go that far and say polished, but that's a little extreme.
Well, we at the museum wanted to thank you for all your support, and we wish you the greatest, success in your endeavors, and let us know when the next book comes out, because that we'll do an interview on, and I'd love to see the cover. We need to wrap this up. And as always, I'd like our listeners to know that this podcast is brought to you by the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center. That's us. And our podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. And I wanted to say to Rick, mahalo for your time today.
And mahalo. Thank you very much for everything.
It has been fun.
Absolutely.